Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Coming up on today's show, we follow up asking our questions about stretch bigs with asking if it's time to drop the drop in defensive coverage. And we also talk about what happens when you rush the process.
This is Nerdish, You Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. It's Friday. That means this is Nerdish, You Wrote. That also means I'm Dave Dufour. I think anyone hosting this show, even if someone's filling in for me, has to say that they're Dave Dufour. I think that's in my contract. I'm here every week with Seth and Mo. What's up, fellas? Everybody doing well?
Doing well. When I hosted the show that one week you were off, I did not say I was Dave Dufour, nor will I if I have to do it in the future, Dave.
And Seth will just host it next time because Seth knows the deal. Everybody stay. Well, I don't know if the polar vortex is hitting you out in California, but it's
nice and degrees here. Nice, beautiful and sunny out here in LA. I think we're going to get like a nice little 70 degree day here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should I take a picture of the sun for you guys?
How's that in Milwaukee?
Cold.
Yeah, pretty cold.
Yeah.
All right. So, Seth, you just wrote at The Athletic in the analytical look around about drop coverage. And you asked the question, and I think it's an important one to ask, you know, especially given what we watched in last year's playoffs and how drop coverage was treated in the bubble generally. Is it time to drop the drop, Seth?
I think it's much more of a situational thing. Part of the problem, it is problematic. Let me say problem a few more times in a row. In the playoffs is like the pull up three, the self created off the bounce three is actually still pretty a rare shot just in terms of which players can take it. I think something like 5 or 10 players were responsible for about 20% of the total self created threes taken in the NBA last year. And those are the players you think they are. But those are also the players you tend to come up against as you go down to the into the playoffs. So, yeah, you're playing against, you know, Brooklyn. Any possible iteration of a ball screening action they run, there's three guys who are just going to, you know, going to tattoo you if you let them step into threes. A more general point is – it's not just the number of threes that teams are shooting. It's the number of players on the floor. And even relative to 3 years ago, teams are certainly employing four guys who are willing to let fly and much more frequently five. And so if you're dropping your big back, all of a sudden, if they have five shooters on the floor, you've essentially already put yourself in rotation without the offense really having to do anything, and rotation is bad for a defense and you want to avoid it. So it's just kind of the rock, paper, scissors nature of the strategy is moving away from that being an all the time thing. Now, if you're playing, say you're playing against the Celtics and they have Tristan Thompson in the game, sure. Drop. Like if he wants to space to the corner, great. And if he wants to roll the rim, great. So you can do that against them. It's recognizing situations where it's not appropriate against opposing personnel.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like there are guys you want to go into drop coverage with and you're okay with. And then there are just guys where it just doesn't make sense. You alluded to the Nets and all three of those guys, right? Like you don't want to do drop coverage against them. Those guys are going to pull up that three that we're talking about. Dame Lillard, Steph Curry, all those guys. But there was something you didn't touch on in there, Seth, in your look around that I think is another reason why to drop the drop coverage. And it's the crossback. Guards are getting so much better at crossing back and now taking advantage of the drop. And that puts them in a situation where they can go at the bigs and, you know, they have the guard behind them. And then, you know, we talked about the bigs popping more, but now it's a 2-on-1 when that big delay rolls after the crossback, because now the big's got to figure out who to go to and who to defend in that sense. And I think that's kind of a problem we're seeing with the drop coverage even more. Like I think, you know, you touched on it with the floaters, and that was a great quotes there between Coach Bickerstaff and Coach Budenholzer about the different philosophies on it. And you went deep into Bickerstaff's quotes. But there was one thing I thought that was really interesting in Bud's quote, which was, you know, that, you know, the entire league has grown in this area because drop coverage has been around now. You know, it's not new. It's not something, you know, it's several years old. It's the iteration of center field. That's basically the worst version of center field. I like center field way more than I like drop coverage because I think you just don't.
It's explain bad the difference.
Well, it's, you know, center field, your big is up. And he's playing both the ball and the roller, buying time for the guard to come over and you know, either the guard to come over and get back in front of the ball or late switch. But it's buying time, but you're not conceding ground. Whereas drop coverage, the guy is waiting for them. You know, the big man's waiting for them in the paint. But I think, you know, that opens the door to the cross back and makes it more easier for these guards to cross back and gives them more options. It makes it easier in the sense, I'm not saying center field would eliminate the crossback at all, but it would just make it a tighter area to come back over. And I think that stuff is interesting. And then, you know, Bud saying like the entire league has grown, that everybody's gotten more looks at it. And I think we're seeing more and more of it. The floater game's getting better for some of these teams, still not a great shot and still not something to live off of, but it's definitely something that I think we're seeing more and more of.
Yeah, I think that that's a great point that you just mentioned about the growth of the game and growth of players. I wonder how much, Seth, and you know, I don't even know how we'd find numbers for this, but I wonder, yeah, of course the three-point rate is part of this, but how much it is just the guys have so much more skill now. Like, I mean, you look at the league 5 years ago, there just wasn't this much guard skill out there. And these guys are able to do things like Mo just mentioned and snake pick and rolls and take advantage and put the bigs in a disadvantageous position. You know, I mean, certainly it's a combination of factors, but what about the skill part of this game? Maybe that's just as big a piece as the threes.
I think it's both the guards, but I think it's just perimeter players in general. I think I remember back one of the first shows we did, we talked about like situations where like Dorian Finney-Smith, like, you know, a 3-and-D wing for Dallas is making like, you know, backside reads coming off a secondary pick and roll. And that's just like, you know, I'm trying to imagine like, you know, early in Danny Green's useful career, like for the, you know, on the 2013 Spurs, Danny Green making a one hand right. pass to the opposite corner out of a pick and roll. And that's just, you know, it's half a decade. And now it's, you know, those kind of reads are just so much more widely dispersed across the league. And some of it, I'm sure, is reps. Some of it is the skill level has gone up. But yeah, no, I agree with you that, you know, unsurprisingly, as more of a premium is placed on skill, players become more skilled.
Right. Well, it makes you money.
Yeah. Well, it's also the players who get selected.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But that, I mean, again, it makes you money. But, you know, the other thing is drop is an extremely conservative defense, right? I completely understand. Like, you are essentially, you're saying we are going to concede certain types of shots and we're going to live with that because we know that the numbers work. And that's why, you know, like drop probably is not going away. I mean, maybe this version of drop, this extreme version of drop that's less center fieldy. But I think that's why you see it so much in the regular season. And then we watch it bomb in the playoffs.
But I think it's something that's it's not going to go away and it shouldn't go away. But it's something that pick and roll defense in general is you got to mix your coverages up. You know, because again, the players are so smart now. And so it's almost like that scene from the original Jurassic Park where the Raptors are testing the fence and looking for the weaknesses. And once they know, okay, this team's going to stay in drop, cool. This is how we're going to counteract. I mean, you know, it opens up opportunities for other things. I mean, hell, it opens up the lane for the Gortat, which I just did on the One Mo Thing video this week. You know, it covers that. I mean, it allows the big now gets to go screen his guy originally to create the lane. I mean, it just makes these things a little bit easier. But I just think teams in general are better served if they're able to switch these things and say, hey, you know, in a timeout, we're going to show. okay, now we're going to go to drop in the next timeout, or, you know, whatever. Just switching these things, I think, is the more valuable thing. It's when you stay in the one coverage, no matter what it is, too long, eventually you're going to get burned by it if you're playing a good team.
That's a, that's a great point. I mean, Eric Name and I wrote about the Bucks specifically, and the thing that we noticed looking at some tape of that is part of the reason why sort of the more center fieldy version works is the guy guarding the ball having pressure from behind is sort of, you know, you get a kind of a hammer and anvil thing going on where they where you know the point guard defender is pushing the guard into the, and not letting him have time and space to, you know, to cross back, to snake the pick and roll, to operate in that area, make him make decisions faster. And what you know, the counter to that is sort of, okay, we might set the pick a little higher up the floor, and instead of like coming off that screen at 100 miles an hour, I'm going to saunter off the screen. Mm-hmm. So if the you know, the big is back, even if I'm, you know, one of the clips he used was from Norm Powell. Norm Powell is not like a dead eye pull up 3-point shooter, but if you let him be prepared to, okay, I'm going to saunter off and shoot a warm up jumper three off of the screen, that's a shot he can make. And so knowing it's coming allows him to come off that screen in second gear. And now if your guard gets stuck on the screen, doesn't get the backside pressure, that's just stepping into a wide open shot. Whereas when it was like a sometimes thing, not everyone was doing it. Okay, I got to come off the screen hard, turn the corner. And like he's right. Coming off the screen, turning the corner and running right into the teeth of the defense. So just right. That those reps of knowing what speed to play at as an offensive player.
Yeah, I just think it's the football analogy, right? Like, it's not just blitzing the quarterback, but it's blitzing in different ways so that the quarterback has to figure out the reads and things like that. And okay, they blitzed from the corner this time. Okay, no. Oh, crap, it's the linebacker. Oh, they didn't blitz and, you know, whatever. It's you just need to buy yourself that extra second defensively to get the guy. So when the guard comes off the screen, oh, crap, they showed. They were in drop last time. Damn it. You know, and now I got to do something else. And that by the time their brain makes that read, hopefully the defender can get back in time and release the big. It's just got to change it up, man. I just think teams stay too solid in one thing. So we're seeing it with the Clippers. I've seen it with a bunch of teams, and I'm just like, got to start being more willing to change.
Yeah, and I, again, back to the regular season defense thing. I think that a lot of it is drop coverage is just, it's a simpler coverage. It's less physically taxing coverage.
It's easier for the bigs.
Right. And I think that part of this has to do with the fact that the season's so long, and that's why you see so much of it in a regular season, right? It is a good – like, if you have good defensive players, you can defend at all-time levels in drop coverage in the regular season. We saw it with the Bucks. It's basically all they did last year, and they were fantastic at it. But then when you get to the playoffs, they don't have reps doing other stuff. And Mo, I know that reps are a big thing for you. We probably talk about getting reps in the regular season for the playoffs more off the podcast than on the podcast. And I know that that's a pet peeve. So, I mean, how much ideally
talking
would teams
off the
be mixing up their
peeve?
Coverage?
Yes, texting with you guys is a pet peeve.
but how much ideally, and I, of course, you know, I'm not asking you to come up with an actual answer, but ideal scenario, what should teams be doing? Because I know, like, look, man, you work for Greg Popovich, and that man is the best regular season lab chemist in basketball history. I mean, he uses it to try stuff, to see what's going to work, to build rotations. Well, how could teams do a better job of mixing in their different coverages so that they're ready for the playoffs?
Well, I think some of that just goes to the nature of being willing to do it. You know, listen, coaches in general are just stubborn. Yeah, like that's just the main fact of it. We're going to keep playing this way. We've all seen the quotes from the same coaches over and over again. No, we just got to do it better and harder, you know, kind of stuff and things like that. It's a willingness to make that change, to make those adjustments and things like that. And it's the willingness to, hey, we're going to drop a game trying to do this and get better. We're going to stay in this zone, even though it's not working right now. We need to see it so I have film so I can look later and see what the problems are or whatnot. And it might hurt us in this regular season game. Easier to do when you're a team that you know is going to the playoffs and you're a team that's fighting for the playoffs and all that stuff. And that's a pod for another time.
Sure.
But I think this is all part of it. And this year is harder because there's no practice. You know, a lot of teams aren't practicing with the whole thing and the pandemic and everything that's going along with it. So it makes it a little more difficult. So it's like, if you're not doing this in games in the regular season, I have no faith that when coach turns to you and says, okay, we're going to start showing on these Kyrie pick and rolls, you know, the guy's going to be like, we haven't practiced this. And you know what? Some guys, you might have guys who are so great with basketball IQ and things like that, they can pull it off, but most can't. And you need the reps to have that and have that understanding. And it's not just those two guys in the pick and roll defending it. It's the help behind it. It's knowing who's tagging the roller. When I tag the roller, who's rotating to my guy and where am I going after that? It's all of those things. So I think it's a very challenging thing. But there's also one more thing and I want to touch on from Seth's story, because I thought this was really great too, was the bluff aspect of it too. Because that's an important part. Because being able to just – it's not a shot you want to live off of in that mid-range, the floater or the mid-range pull-off, but you just need to make enough. And nobody knows the number. You just need to make enough to make the defense have to go, crap, I need to be up more. And then from there, it's a whole different game.
It's – I mean, it's – you know, I like to make poker analogies because I like poker. But it's the concept, you know, known as balancing your ranges. Like if you only – okay, the – he goes all in only when he has aces. You're pretty easy to play against. You win the blinds if you have aces, because you went all in. Everyone's like, oh, you got aces, and they all fold. That's not great. What happens now? Okay, he only goes all in if he has aces and 7-2 offsuit. Well, now you're going in way too much, because you know you'll get 7-2 offsuit more often, and so I'll just call every time, because you know I can not look at my cards and know I have on average better hand than he does. So somewhere in between there is sort of the baby bear, where you're deceptive enough to make people worry and wonder and react, but not like so deceptive, quote unquote, that you're making bad plays often. And that's, you know, that's, we've talked about this a number of different ways when we talked to the mid range. It's again, it's the ideal number of mid range is just enough so that the other team guards it and no more. And finding out what that level is, I would say from an empirical standpoint, it's impossible, but it's just, yeah, that's what we're going for. You're doing that, like you said, Mo, to open up the dump off to the rim, to open up the pitch to the corner. And it goes against everything we know as basketball players, as basketball coaches, to, he just hit that floater, that 14-foot runner twice in a row. Maybe I need to just take an extra step up. Where if you really got into the math of it, probably like, yeah, go ahead, hit 12 of those in a row, then we'll talk. But just the natural reaction is you want to take that one step up, and now you just got dunked on.
And that's why the dunker spot is so important against drop coverage.
Shouts to two of our favorite podcasts in a row.
That's right. So Seth, you know, one of the things that really like kind of caught me off guard, you have this, this graph chart, where you track the average 3-point field goal attempts per 100 possessions by lineup. And then individually by each player in the lineup. Yeah. And I know that this sounds nerdy, and please, everybody, just go to The Athletic and look at this chart. But I was shocked that the lowest man in the lineup in the 2007-2008 season was 0.2 three-point attempts. Like, that tracks in my brain. The idea that it's now two attempts, meaning the lowest number of 3-point field goal attempts per 100 possessions on average in any given 5-man lineup is two. Everyone in this league shoots threes now. That's just it. It's like, this is a 3-point league, but I am shocked that the number is that high.
No, I think that, and even, like I said, even from 4 years ago, just you look at like, you know, it's mostly like the fourth and fifth shootiest players in a lineup tend to be the 4 and 5, but it's not always that way, but it tends to be. And you look even at just those spots on the floor, how much more those players are shooting, both on like an average basis, but also just in terms of who's in the lineup. Like there are people who are credible shooters 4 most of the time now, 5 a good chunk of the time now. Whereas, like you said, you know, 10 years ago, there's 2.5, 3. And that's just such a big difference in the amount of space that a defense has to worry about at any one time. If you have four guys spaced out and you have to guard them all, that's a lot different than a guy you can he's spotted up at 18 feet on the baseline. You don't want to give up that shot, but you're okay with that shot.
There are 27 guys in the NBA averaging 7 three-point attempts or more this season. In the 15-16 season, which was Steph Curry's unanimous MVP season, there were 8.
Some of that is pace.
Certainly. You're getting more shots up. But the three-point, we know this. Yeah. We're not breaking new ground here that, hey, guys are shooting threes. But I think that it does, to me, put in perspective why the drop coverage ultimately is not – that's not like championship defense. I don't think you're going to win a championship playing drop coverage.
It can be part of, but it can't be the only thing.
But it can't be exclusive.
That's the thing. And there are teams we know that exclusively go to drop coverage. I mean, Philly's a team that does it with Embiid. Like, that's a mm-hmm. That's going to be a problem for them come playoff time, and that's a concern. And this is the stuff that you got to figure out as you're going through it. Now, luckily for Philly, they have some long arm guards that are going to fight around over the picks.
It helps if Ben Simmons is the guy getting the backside pressure because he's 6'11". So that's
not even right. that. Yeah. Go look at – there's a clip. I'll send you guys the clip. Maybe I'll tweet it with this. Oh, but there's a clip of Matisse Thybulle in the game against Sacramento.
Yeah, these are big long arm guys.
And he covers the drop. He actually got screened, and Embiid did a good job of not giving up too much space to Fox, who was tearing him up all game until the fourth quarter, and Thybulle was able to recover, and it just made a huge difference. And I think that's the balance teams are going to have to figure out. But, I mean, you're right, Dave. If it's solely your defense, if that's your number one, you're going to have problems.
All right. So I texted you guys the other day about the Mavericks, and looking at the roster, and it got me thinking a little bit about the process. Now they got Luka Doncic, who is, he's going to be a Hall of Famer. This guy may go down as one of the greatest players of all time. I mean, obviously this is very early in his career. I'm just projecting high end for Luka Doncic. And when you have that sort of player, there certainly is a lot of pressure now. Like, we got to start winning now. We already know that people are talking about the clock ticking on guys 1 year in the league. I mean, I've literally seen that about Zion Williamson. That's frustrating. But there is, the process has been derided and also lauded in Philadelphia. The tank until you get all the picks and get good players, and then you build up from there.
Can I give a quick aside?
Yeah, absolutely.
The players that Philly came up from that, how would a team whose rotation was Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, I'm doing this from memory, so I might miss a couple, Christian Wood, Rashawn Holmes, Robert Covington, TJ McConnell, and I'm forgetting one or two others. Like, that's a pretty good team. So, anyway. I don't know if they drafted well or not. That's certainly a controversial thing, but they drafted and signed a lot. And and that was the point, is no one's actually that good and that much better at this than anybody else. So let's just do it a lot and we'll come out ahead. And it
takes more bites at the apple.
Yeah. Anyway.
Right. Absolutely. Right. But their process, they had a process, right? This is our plan going forward. We're going to take a ton of bites at the apple. Well, it got me thinking about Dallas, because I think Dallas may have rushed their process. They're not the only team. They're just the one that I thought of first. And we of course, talked about some other ones. But when you look at Dallas getting Luka Doncic in the draft, I don't think they expected to be in that position, right? They kind of lucked into the trade. Fortuitous for them. They make the Kristaps Porzingis deal. And now, all of a sudden, you're a different team than you were when you were just the team that was able to draft Luka Doncic. And maybe you're going to be bad for a couple seasons as you build around him, but now you're a team that's spent money and has okay players, and you're expected to compete. I think that this is not necessarily a good thing for them. I think it's probably a bad thing for them long-term, because it feels like they tried to speed the process up and may have gotten themselves stuck in a bad place.
I'll go, Seth. I disagree.
Okay.
And here's why, in the sense of, first off, the Sixers rushed the process, right? They kind of threw it out and made trades to go get Jimmy Butler and things like that. And they had gotten older in the process of spending a ton of money and things like that, you know, in that sense, and it didn't work out. And we know that whole story. When I look at the Mavs, Dave, they're still a very young team. I know they spend a lot of money, and there's not, you know, the Porzingis contract looks rough with the injuries and his injury history and stuff and things like that. He's slowly getting better. I'm feeling a little more and more confident in how he's looking as a player. But I think, you know, at the time of the trade, it was, we're pairing him with another young guy, you know, and these are going to be our cornerstones. Now, we can argue whether you should have done that with Porzingis or whatnot till our faces turn blue. But that was their bet. I don't feel like they were abandoning their process. And I feel like the moves they've made since all make sense to me. May not pan out, but I can go, no, that move makes sense. It's not a move where I'm sitting there going, like, I can see their line of thinking. I'm not sitting there going, like, what the hell are they doing? This was dumb. Why did you do this? This is a scenario. And I think they're in a position where it's like, look, they're tied to these guys. They're hoping injury bug doesn't kill them. But this is the scenario, and I still think they're going to be able to make moves.
Do you not think that there might have been a little bit of utility for them to go a couple of years in the lottery? I mean, like, I understand that maybe Luka is good enough that he keeps him out of the lottery. I don't know.
No, because you're going into the lottery to try to get, like, okay, injury stuff aside, maybe they, like, you know, hindsight 2020, maybe they misevaluated, like, the health risk for him. Maybe they didn't. And they've hit, like, you know, the 40th percentile outcome or something like that. But you're going into the lottery because, like, I think, you know, Kristaps Porzingis has, like, kind of quote unquote healthy Kristaps Porzingis is an all-star player. True or false?
True.
It's probably true.
Yeah. Or is at least in that discussion of player.
He's in that discussion. Sure.
You're going into the lottery to get that.
You might get that.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, you hope to get bites of getting that. So trading to get that, that's fine. There's some sort of bad luck there. Then there's questions you might ask about some of the fill-in moves around. I mean, the one that, like, our Mavericks people would point to probably is Dwight Powell's contract is the big one for a guy who kind of doesn't really fit, like, modern NBA basketball. Yeah. A non-shooting, yeah, non-rim protecting four is a tough place to spend money in the modern, yeah, NBA. So, but that's, you know, I don't know if that's a rushing of the process so much as, you know, a misevaluation of a specific player.
And then when you look at Dallas,
I was gonna say it's like if you're like, I kind of want to, the team they played last night, or according on Thursday, the team they played last night, the team I would be more worried about having rushed is Atlanta.
Yes. A lot of long-term money
for guys who, you know, okay, fine. Like, Bogdanović is hurt. What, like, that's, you can't hold that against him, but still, like,
oh, I'm going to one. It's my turn. Go ahead.
You know, they may have paid too much for him, regardless of that. And then, like, long-term money to, you know, you trade for Capella, long-term money for Gallinari. Now you have this weirdness with John Collins, and, you know, it turns out that DeAndre Hunter's actually good. And now you have this kind of weird logjam at positions, and you've spent all your future flexibility. You're giving a lot of money to guys who are, you know, Bogdanović is not young. Gallinari is not young.
All right.
In retrospect, it's maybe a little worrisome that you signed Gallinari for all this money. And then he's like, oh, sure, I'll come off the bench.
Right.
But that's neither here nor there.
So first, just to conclude on the Mavs here real quick, they're only two games right now, as we're talking Thursday, you know, of
being out of the playing games
and, like, two and up. Yeah, I think they're going to be fine long term, ceiling wise and things, health, you know, working out the way it hopefully does. So I'm not worried about them. I'm 100% on board with Seth on the questions for the Hawks and rushing their process, because it's not even that they went and got these guys. It's how they're using them. And I get it. Bogdanović is hurt or whatever. But even when he wasn't and he was healthy, he wasn't playing on the ball as much. You know, it was more Trae Young still doing all his Trae Young stuff and then kicking it to Bogdanović. I thought they were going to change things and they were going to change their offense a little bit and have Trae Young work more off the ball. And you know, we're seeing Leafs with the young kids that they probably weren't expecting to see. And now it's like, okay, now we have a lot of guys in a position. The Gallinari thing, I know he's in a minutes restriction and things like that, and fine, he's okay with not starting, which was, I'm with Seth, kind of weird. He doesn't even get shots when he's in the game. I forget he's in games. It's, you're not even using your guys. You went and you rushed the process to get all these guys, and then you're just not using them. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
How about a team that maybe has rushed the process but has done it well? How about the Phoenix Suns? Because there's an argument to be made that signing Chris Paul and Jay Crowder, which, by the way, both signings, I mean, or the trade for Chris Paul and the signing of Jay Crowder, both working out wonderfully. But this team, I just think Booker being farther in his career is the difference there. I think Phoenix has done a good job of kind of maybe not even rushing the process. Maybe this was all in their plan all along, but just saying, hey, look at what we just did in the bubble. Look at what we were doing leading into the bubble. These two pieces could actually get us into a better position, and they still maintained their true, like, long-term flexibility is still pretty good. I think Phoenix is a good example of a team that said, hey, we're going to throw some chips on the table and speed this up a little bit.
I don't see. I kind of reject a little bit that they rushed the process a little bit, that they're one of these teams. Part of it is, you said it, you know, like, Booker's deeper into his career. It's what, I don't know. I don't have his contract stuff in front of me, but what is he, a free agent in 2 years or 3 years? I know he's had the extension and mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, okay, that's actually a ticking clock versus, right, you know, when people say maybe Zion, who's like in his second year in the league. And by the way, when he is a free agent, it's going to be restricted. And I'm assuming he doesn't already sign the extension. It's like, I highly doubt New Orleans is going to let him go. So, you know, it's a bit of a different scenario in that sense. So for me, it's not even them kind of rushing the process. It's, our time is now. And that's the time has come to put the chips in the middle. You threw a wrestling reference in there and I completely flummoxed. So, you know, I'm not wearing jean shorts. That's the only thing I know, or jorts or whatever the hell he wears.
Yeah. Leave Josh Hilson out of it.
Now I'm way lost. But Phoenix is saying, like, look at what we did in the bubble. Our young guys are ready. Let's push the chips in the middle and let's upgrade. And it's not like they gave up that much.
They really did
to get Chris Paul, you know, and it's not like Ricky Rubio was a spring chicken, you know, right. He was there for 1 year and they're like, look, we did this with Rubio. Imagine what it will look like when we have a better guy. And that's kind of the plan there. And then the Crowder coming in, it wasn't a rush process job. It was
a jump start.
It was, let's go. It's go time. Mm-hmm. Let's go. It was the starter's gun went off for them and they said, hey, all right, let's make this thing happen. And I think that's why I'll push a little bit on Phoenix in that sense, but I love what they did.
Well, and this is, so I think they were pragmatic. I'm not saying that they were rushing. I'm saying they were jump-starting. All right, maybe that's a better way to say it. But I think that sort of pragmatism would have served Dallas and Atlanta a little bit. I mean, I just think that seeing what the landscape looks like after you've, you know, had a guy for a year or two or three kind of matters. And you know, it isn't to say that I actually like the fact that Dallas and Atlanta want to be good. I think, you know, this has actually been a really good season if you're anti-tanking, because, I mean, even Oklahoma City, we can't say that they're tanking because they play too well. I mean, they just push the Lakers to overtime.
Really wants a different story. Well,
sure. But, you know, but still, they have good players and they're playing hard.
They're playing.
And to me, like, that's great for the league in general. But I do think that pragmatism, when you have long-term success goals like Dallas and Atlanta, I mean, they want to be perennial finals contenders. And it's just hard to do that when you jump the gun. Like if you take the first offer you can get, you're usually not getting the best one. And I wonder if that's an issue for them. Now, there are a couple of teams that I think are being very patient and somehow still coming up gold.
Before we go there, I don't think they've jumped the gun. I think Dallas, now it may not have worked out.
You don't think Dallas did, but you think Atlanta did.
Oh, I 100% think Atlanta did.
Sure.
But I think Dallas just may have made the wrong calculation on Porzingis.
Sure.
But I don't think they jumped the gun. That's the
I don't even think their process was bad on getting Porzingis. It's not about, you know, like, of course you sign a player and he has injury issues a little bit out of your hands. But sure. But to a certain degree, I wonder if they had waited a year, if they might not be in a better place now because, you know, you didn't necessarily know what you had.
Could be in a worse place.
Could be in a worse place. You're right. But the two teams that I think have done a really good job of being pragmatic, and of course, they kind of have to just given the markets. But you mentioned Oklahoma City. I mean, just using their assets to get more assets that they're going to have control over because it's a small market. You're not signing anybody. And Memphis has just been, I mean, just doing a great job of using their available draft capital to get players that are good and can play. I mean, it's amazing to look at the difference between Dallas, Phoenix, and Atlanta and Memphis and Oklahoma City. Of course, bigger markets, small market dynamics at play there. But Memphis and Oklahoma City, to me, their pragmatism is going to pay off in a similar way without maybe having a Devin Booker, a Luka Doncic, or a Trae Young. Although I do think
John
Morant's in that. He's in that conversation.
No, I think the fact that it's a supposedly one player draft, and the second player in the draft is Ja Morant, and he's great. And Shai Gilgeous-Alexander looks like someone who's going to be on all star shortlists for years to come. So that starting with that sort of shot creating building block is. It helps. It certainly allows you to, especially if you're not on like a rush timeline, it doesn't seem like, Sam Presti has a job for life. So he can operate on whatever time frame he wants. The management in Memphis is new, this is their second year. So they certainly have a lot of runway in front of them and with how they've performed so far, doesn't seem like there's any sort of hot seat action there. So that, I think you do have to acknowledge that there's a certain dynamics that, maybe didn't exist I think it's fair to say that Atlanta probably had a little more pressure on them to be good now than Memphis and Oklahoma City did. Not even probably, like, I think we can definitively say that, especially with respect to Oklahoma City. And so that, recognizing that those that impetus is there doesn't absolve you for not not doing smart things, but it helps to understand why certain strategies were decided upon.
Well, we talk about this all the time with coaches that are GMs, right? Like the GM is always going to try to help the coach in that situation sometimes at the expense of teams. But it happens with GMs as well, right? Like GMs are always going to try to keep their jobs for the most part. So of course he's going to, they're going to go throw money and try to, fill needs. I mean, look, I actually think Bogdanovich in Atlanta makes a ton of sense. I like Gallo for that team. It's just that the money is a lot and the length of the deals are a lot. And then like Mo mentioned, well, at this point we kind of can say we don't really know what it would look like, but when everybody was there,
Bogdanovich was playing completely off the ball. So you're just,
and it made no sense.
You're,
so,
you're paying it's just $18 million a year for an okay spot up shooter.
Mm-hmm, and right. You could have gotten that at a discount elsewhere. And I think
Langston Galloway's on a minimum, in Phoenix.
Right. But Seth touched on something that was really important there too. It's having that job security and that longevity. And another guy that we should mention too is New Orleans and David Griffin, who also has, a good runway in front of him and time and things like that. And I think all three of these teams all are in that situation where they can build slowly and there's no time clock. There's no rush to really make something happen right now. Part of the problem for the Hawks was, Lloyd Pierce came out last year and said they're going to make the playoffs in this season. So that's, I mean, first off, as a coach, you never make that guarantee, man. You come on, man, under promise, over deliver. But the whole, you know, thing, but that put that notion in the owner's eyes. All right, well, let's go now. And now they've spent a ton of money. We got to go. So now you're in that situation. So Oklahoma City, Memphis, and New Orleans are all different scenarios in that sense of they're not going to be a free agent destination. Maybe New Orleans more than the other two. But I think all that matters in how they build. And they have all these assets now, draft assets and things. And really New Orleans and Oklahoma City, it's how do they build from that? And it's going to be just kind of, I think for them, it makes sense to be patient and let's go and things like that. I think for the other teams that made moves, for the most part, all of them made sense to me. I just think the Hawks are screwing it up by not playing their guy when they could, running a system that makes sense. But overall, it's just like, man, there are times where we've seen teams jump the process, like the Sixers team, and it was like, yo, that's too soon. Your guys aren't ready.
Something with New Orleans that I think is interesting. I wonder, and again, I'm just thinking out loud here, I wonder if there's some internal pressure this summer to make big upgrades because of, I mean, Zion, to be honest with you. Not just that the clock is ticking or whatever people are going to say, but they want to put him on national television. Now, I don't know if that, I mean, Seth, you could probably speak to this a little bit better, but could you feel like, do you think that the team could feel pressure to try to be better because of that, those sort of expectations?
I think that the difference, as Mo talked about, is there's a difference between a guy being in the second year of his rookie contract and a second year of his second contract is pretty huge. Like there was, you know, it wasn't always straightforwardly acknowledged, but the elephant was in every room with Giannis. You know, you're just not under that pressure with a guy in a rookie contract. Just be mm-hmm. just like you have as the team, you just hold so many extra cards in that scenario. I think that the interesting thing with New Orleans is they're sort of we're kind of seeing them as sort of in the process of shedding their skin. Like you do that, you do the holiday trade for what they got for holiday. You do that, you know, a guy not on your timeline.
Absolutely.
You know, you get
great
that
deal for them.
Yeah. You make that trade, you know, 12 times out of 10. The effect of that trade, though, is that like this year, your team is a little weird. Like we've talked about this before, like, and, you know, both on the pod and on Twitter, like they're starting lineup, they're starting their five best players and there's five guys who want to play four styles. And so it doesn't really work, but that's sort of what you ended up with. And that's not the finished form of the team. You know, there's a lot of figuring out where the pieces go. And right now it doesn't fit. Doesn't mean that they're done. It just means that right now the pieces don't fit. You know, to illustrate that, I mean, I'm, you know, in the middle of my shot quality series. I did kind of a quick and dirty shot model, based with the stuff you can get off.
Just the way I like it.
What's that?
Quick and dirty. Just the way I like it. Quick and dirty. Quick and dirty, Seth, yeah, let's go. That's how I want all my shot models.
Oh boy. that's the second tape title you've dropped today, by the way. So among players who've taken at least 200 shots this year, the guy who's taken the most difficult shots on average is Carmelo Anthony. The guy who's taking the second most difficult shots on average is Brandon Ingram. And with like, that doesn't totally make sense to have one guy who is forced to take shots that difficult for a team like that. But I think that is illustrative of them trying to figure out how things go. And I think we've talked about not loving the ISO BI offense and wanting to do more to, you know, involve Zion and Ingram in the same plays and so on and so forth. But the point being, I think that not totally worrying that it's you worry about it, but it's not like, oh no, our team doesn't make sense this year, we're doomed. It's like, no, we're, you know, this is we're in like version 1.5 of this team, and next year it'll be teenagers. Version 2.0. yeah
they're trying to figure out who they are. They're still, they don't know who they are yet. They're freshmen in high school, you know, kind of level. Like they're just trying to figure out who they are and where they're going from, what they're going to be down the road. And that's fine.
Okay. Well, as we wrap up, kind of like we do almost every single week.
Utah. Go to Utah.
Yeah, I'm getting us to Utah. That's how I'm wrapping up.
Oh, my bad.
Okay. All right. All right. Now I got to put that in the notes.
I thought it was a section.
So as we wrap up, as we do, you know, just about every week, we want to talk about some of the things that we're kind of looking at in the week ahead. And Seth, you brought up a really great point before we started the show, and it goes back to our conversation about the Denver Nuggets last year, which, to be fair, I can understand people were a little bit upset in the, I don't know, I'm not going to say we infantilized them, but we certainly treated them like the kid brother.
No.
But they graduated
no,
from that.
No.
They graduated from that.
No, we, like, I was describing.
We collective.
The, yeah, we collectively. Yes. I was just, I yes. was describing them a certain way. I wasn't actually.
Yeah.
I was not actually patting Denver on the head. I was saying we right. collectively. Anyway.
The collective we.
Yeah, the collective
we. And you mentioned Utah as a team that we may be collectively patting on the head. I disagree with you. I think if you're 20-5, like, you're a good basketball team and
hold on.
No. But I'm saying, I think that that what I've seen has mostly been people potentially even over respecting the Utah Jazz, much less so than just patting them on the head. And I mean, they're a good basketball team. I think they're getting legitimate praise, Seth. I don't think it's just, oh, you're cute. And I do think they're going to get mollywopped by the Lakers, but they're still a good basketball team.
That's it. And no, and the thing is I can't disagree with you at all. And it's, right. And so it's, and that's one of those, that's just the weird things about this season is Utah is great. And then they're going to play LeBron or Kawhi in the playoffs and they're going to get windshielded. Like,
I would say just LeBron, not Kawhi. I think this Utah team can beat this current iteration of the Clippers.
Yeah. I like the way they match up.
I think Utah's got a better chance against this iteration of the Clippers. Cause when you look at the Clippers, they don't get anything easy. There are never easy shots. They don't average a ton of free throw attempts. They're in the bottom 25, I think, in points in the paint. They don't run as much. Now listen, make it a point guard. Whole different story. Then I'll decide. But this current roster, even with Beverly coming back and things like that, I'm not convinced this team's going to beat Utah in a 7-game series.
They have two guys that Utah has nobody to guard.
But they play a better brand of team basketball than this Clipper team did, and this is the exact conversation we had in the Boston Miami series last year. And this is a team that understands themselves better. They have a better flow with each other. They all, for the most part, have played together and have more continuity than this Clipper team. And I think that's something. I'm not calling it now. I'm just saying I'm not convinced when we're talking getting mollywopped. Lakers are a different story. Lakers are another deal. We're talking about that. I think that at very least is a very, very tough series for the Clippers, despite the fact that you're right, Seth. Utah doesn't have an answer for those two guys.
You know, but I'm with you, Mo. I think that's like a toss-up.
I think that is a much tougher series than the Clippers. Now, I have a lot of questions about their offense, and that's going to be something I'll have down the road. But the when I look at this Utah team, you know, and maybe they are a path ahead. Oh, it's a cute deal. But the team we did that to last year went to the Western Conference Finals. Like, that's a good ceiling for you. I didn't have Utah making the Western Conference Finals at the beginning of this year.
Is it worth noting that Denver had a losing record in the playoffs last year?
Oh, no.
I'm just, you know.
Oh, no.
They got just to the conference womp, finals.
Womp. Oh, yeah, womp, womp. Yeah. Like, yeah, they failed up. Congratulations to them. Congratulations to us for finishing the show. That's going to do it, folks. For Seth, for Mo, I'm Dave. Thanks for listening, as always, and we'll be back next week with more Nerdy She Wrote on the Athletic NBA Show.